I am telling you, McDonald's can be the new American church. Feeding bodies and feeding souls, and it ain't just open on Sundays, boys.
Whoa, intense. That's Michael Keaton delivering a particularly gripping line in The Founder, a movie about the origin story of McDonald's. And even if you love a Big Mac, and I know some of you do, I still doubt that you think of McDonald's as your church. But is that what McDonald's kinda is, was, or has been in this country? I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll hear about the role of McDonald's in the incredible life stories of a few Kansas Cityans. We'll get back to the movie later in the hour. To start, I'd like to welcome Nabil Haddad to the show. In Kansas City, you may recognize him through another burger joint, Winstead's, but his story wouldn't be what it is without McDonald's, and it starts in Iraq. Hi, Nabil.
Hi.
So now you're of Lebanese descent and you've lived in both Israel and Lebanon as a boy. There are tons of stories from that part of your life, but I want to fast forward if that's okay, because the part of your journey that takes you to America and McDonald's is an epic tale and I want to hear all of it. So let's start here. It's 1958. There's a civil war in Lebanon and you've gone to Baghdad to live with relatives to stay safe during the conflict. You end up selling records and magazines during the day and burgers and Cokes at night. Tell me about that time in your life.
Well, it was a very interesting time. As you said, that I basically fled Lebanon because by that time the Christians and the Muslims were killing each other. And my father wanted to save his firstborn son. So when I got to Baghdad to live with my mother's sister and her family, I was there only 1 week, from Monday the 7th of July to the 14th of July, when they had a revolution and they killed King Faisal and the entire royal family, so nobody will have a claim on the kingdom. And there were curfews. There was a lot of killing, dragging colonels and generals in the streets, naked. It was atrocious. And I lived with my uncle, who was in charge of all the news in Baghdad, UPS, Associated Press. So anything that happened, he knew right away.
How did you end up running... It started with the records and magazines. How did that happen?
Well, I got a job at a publishing and distribution company. After I was there only 3 days, through the revolution, they made a rule that nobody who is not an Iraqi can work in an Iraqi company. So I lost my job after 3 days. And the owner of the company recommended that if I want to open a shop, sell magazines and books and newspapers, that he will give me stuff on consignment because I didn't have any money. So sure enough, I got me a small shop, like maybe 30 by 40, and loaded up with books, magazines, and I started getting the newspapers that were cleared by the security. There was a lot of problems getting American magazines because they said something bad about Iraq, so they won't go in. We only got a few once a week.
And your customers were people who worked at embassies, right?
I was close to all the embassies, so most of them were French, British, and American embassy employees. And the Iraqis really didn't have any money, and they had no interest in books and magazines as much as the foreigners.
Tell me, I mean, I'm going to get right back to that, but how did it happen that it went from that during the day to selling Cokes and burgers at night?
After I was there at the shop, a gentleman from Dallas, Texas, Gene Harbaugh, he came to me and he said, listen, in America, now mind you, this is 1959. In America, we sell hamburgers. I didn't know what hamburger was. So he told me, we went to the Coca-Cola and rented a shack. I had my little cousin who was 12 years old who get us meat and buns. And he showed me how to make hamburgers. At that time, we didn't have ketchup. We only had mustard and onions and buns. And so it was so popular. We were at a very good bus station, and people would line up the street. And I finally had to send my cousin and say, go count 24, because that's all we can serve anymore. And I got done from 6 o'clock to about 7, 7:30, and we were out of hamburgers every night. by the time, you know, I was 19 years old, I became a tycoon.
the teenage tycoon.
That's right.
So one day, just really out of the blue, you were arrested. What happened?
Well, as I told you, that most of my customers were American embassy employees or British or French. And I went on a Monday morning with a lot of subscribers for magazines and news and time. And so I was ready to go. My cousin will deliver some on his bicycle. And I'll deliver some in my car. There's these two guys dressed in suits. He said, come with us. I said, no, sir, I'm really very busy right now. He said, no, you need to come with us. I said, you didn't hear me. I am very busy. I got to deliver all these newspapers. And I said, you're under arrest.
Oh, in that case, I'll come with you.
I mean, I was shocked.
Yeah.
And the rest for what? So they took me to jail in the interrogation room after I was there for like 3 hours wondering why I'm here. They took me to the interrogation room, and here's this captain sitting down and two sergeants on each of his side. And he looked at me and said, you're the spy. You're spying for Americans, French, and British. I was shocked again. I said, you got to be out of your mind. You're crazy. He said, you're not only a spy, you're a rude spy. I tell you what we do with spies. Every Saturday, we hang them. We hang 12 of them. I said, we have 11, and you're number 12. I said, listen, I'm a businessman. I sell magazines, newspapers, albums. I have nothing to do with politics, and I don't care about politics. I said, I'm a young guy. I'm just a businessman. He didn't buy it. He said, throw him in jail until he's ready to talk. That was at noon. Ready to talk? What am I going to talk about? I had nothing to say.
So tell me the story of how you got out of that bind and ended up somehow in America.
Well, one of my father's good friends was a colonel in the Iraqi college, which like West Point here. He was not with the revolutionaries, and he was not with the generals who reported to the king. And my father said, well, as soon as you get to Baghdad, call him, make contact with him. He'll take care of you. So I did call this guy. This colonel, he came and gave me his card with his number on it, said, if you ever need anything, call me. Well, I was sitting there saying, what am I going to do? These guys are crazy. So there was a guard outside the door, and I said, listen, what time you get off? I said, 3 o'clock. I said, listen, I really need you to call this number, and he wouldn't do it. I said, when you go home, just somewhere call this guy and tell him I'm here. To make a long story short, I said, listen, I have 3 dinars in my pocket, which is an awful lot of money in those days, more than he makes in 2 months. I'll give it to you, and please call him. All you have to do is tell him I'm here. I'm at the jail. Well, I wasn't too sure what they're going to do or not, but 5 o'clock comes. Here's this army car, and I can see it through this small, tiny 5x5 window in the courtyard. Here comes this colonel. That was good. They come and get me out of jail, take me in the interrogation room, and as soon as he got into the interrogation room, the captain and the sergeant stood up and saluted him. Well, that was a good sign.
Yeah. And so they just let you out on his word?
They told him that I was a spy. He said, you must have made a mistake. I know his father, I know his mother. Actually, he married a Lebanese woman, stayed at our house for 10 days for his honeymoon. No hotels over there. I said, I know him well. His father built homes for all the Iraqi workers because it was Iraq British Oil Company. I'll take him into my custody. He didn't even wait for him to say yes or no. He just grabbed me by my hand and took me down to his car, and we took off.
And so you must have found out how it is that you came to be confused for a spy.
I sure did. Not for 21 years.
Tell the story quickly, and then we'll get back to burgers.
All right. One of my good customers was Sue Folsom from Salina, Kansas. She'll come and buy a book and bring it back 2 days later, sell it again. She keeps buying stuff, and I'm making a fortune selling the same thing twice. She came to me on Tuesday, said, where were you yesterday? It was Monday. I was closed. I said, I told her the story of what happened with the Iraqi Secret Service. I said, that's crazy. I said, that's what I told him. And he thought I was rude. He said, now what are you going to do? I said, Sue, I don't know what I'm going to do. I can't go back to Lebanon. I can't go back to Palestine. I'm stuck. She said, would you like to go to America? I said, I don't know anything about America. She said, you need to finish college or go to school. Wednesday morning, she came in there. Now, the colonel told me I have to be ready Wednesday noon. Shut the shop down, sell everything, return everything, and I'm going to take you to the border to get you out of here. The borders were closed. You couldn't get in and you couldn't get out.
But somehow she did it.
Somehow she came the next day and had 10 telegrams. Boston College, Michigan State, Penn State, Purdue, Colorado State. I said, what do you like to go? I said, I like mountains, no skiing. She said, go to Colorado. So that's where I went.
And it turns out, I mean, I hate to spoil the story, but it turns out that you sort of inadvertently were participating in spying through Sue.
I ran into Sue in Salina, Kansas when I snowed in going to Colorado. She picked me up at the Holiday Inn, go to her house, cracking a beer, drinking a beer. First thing I said, how dumb the Iraqis were arresting me for being a spy for you. She said, no, they weren't dumb. I said, what do you mean? She said, I headed the CIA in Baghdad. When they arrested you, we realized they uncovered who we were.
And, yeah, she had been passing notes in those books that she was buying and reselling in your store.
Every book had notes or whatever. And she said, then Leo Coates, the British guy, comes in there and said, do you have any cha-cha records? I said, I don't have one, but I have one
records. For you. Yeah, I mean, I love that this is the tools of espionage.
Yeah, first is the Maurice from the French embassy. He was in charge of the library. He comes to me, said, my fiancé want to learn how to dance cha-cha. I got him an album. 2 days later, he brings it open. Oh, she didn't like it. Sell it again. Leo Coates from the British embassy comes. Do you have any cha-cha albums? I said, yeah, I have one that's used. I'll send it to you half price. No, we'll pay full price. He said, my two daughters want to learn how to dance. I was passing stuff like an idiot, not knowing what is going on. Books, magazines, and stuff. I was wheeling and dealing, thinking I'm just a smart businessman, but these guys were using me. Sue Folsom went to the ambassador and said, we need to get this kid out of here. They'll kill him. I said, no, Sue, we cannot be involved emotionally with these people. I said, not these people. This kid put his life for us.
That certainly explains how she was able to get you out of the country. Well, I mean, so we're skipping way forward, but what brought you to McDonald's? I mean, that's why we're talking today.
Right.
What brought you to McDonald's?
So I go for Cons, Colorado. I had zero money. My father gave me some money for first quarter, and I spent it. And so now, a year after I got there in 59, Peggy, my first date and my last date, I've been married to her 57 years. I thought if you're man enough to be married, you should be man enough to support yourself. Start looking for a job. Went to McDonald's. I have a help wanted sign. I love McDonald's because, you know, I mean, I'm a burger man. So to make a long story short, again, I went seven different times. Every time he said, I'm reviewing application, I'm checking applications, and I'll let you know. He never let me know. So I told my wife, this guy's not going to hire me. I went there and said, sir, you're not going to hire me, and I don't blame you. I speak with an accent, and you get a lot of other people on the job. I'll work for you for free for 2 weeks. You like me, hire me. After 2 weeks, you don't have to hire me. No hard feelings. I was in a McDonald's hat, apron, and shirt. The very next day, I stopped working.
And so, in those 2 weeks, what happened?
First day, I get there, and he said, put 6 buns on. Even though I'm an experienced hamburger, I didn't know what a bun was. Where I come from, it's bread. Oh, okay. Walter, show this guy. Then he said, never mind, put 6 patties on. I didn't know what a patty was. Where I come from, it's meat. Show them what a patty is. Anyway, ketchup, mustard, pickle, onion, and the 6 of them, we pushed them up. For him, he's at the front, start wrapping, and he wrapped 5 of them. And he pushed the tray by my nose and said, cheese it. I said, sir, I'm not hungry. I want to show my men of endurance. I don't have to eat right away. He said, no, I didn't say eat it. I said, cheese it. I said, sir, you didn't hear me. I'm not hungry. I said, Walter, show this kind of dummy what to do. Oh, where I come from, put a piece of cheese on it. That would work.
Not cheese it.
Not cheese it. So he said, never mind, go clean the bathroom. And, you know, I come from a middle-class family. We had two servants in Lebanon. And here I am in America trying to be an engineer. I'm going to the bathroom. What greets you in the bathroom is a mirror. And I'm looking at that mirror and say, what is happening to me? I didn't know what to do, but there was a bucket, a brush, and a chamois. So I cleaned the bathroom walls, mirror, and the floor. And I went back outside. He came in there in the bathroom. He looked at it and said, that's a good job. I said, from now on, you clean the bathroom every day.
So how did you rise up through the ranks at McDonald's, starting in that glorious position of cleaning the bathrooms for no pay?
I was extremely serious about my job. I worked for 2 weeks for nothing. And after 2 weeks, he paid me 80 cents an hour, which he was paying high school kids 85 and college kids a dollar. I was so grateful. And so I worked while the other three kids played in the back. And they'll say, you're a dummy. You're not paying you anything. Why don't you just come and play with us, cards, or do something? I said, no, I'm going to do my job. So in 2.5 months, he went on vacation. Now, he instructed me and the manager, I must not work the window, which is where the customers come, to interact with them. I should stay in the back.
Why?
Because of my accent. He didn't want me to be talking to them. The manager, while he was gone on vacation, he said, go work the window. I said, well, you know, the owner does not want me to do that. I said, no, I'm going to tell you, just go there. I went there, and I was very fast, mathematically, you know, arithmetically I was fast. By the time the customer gave me an order, I tell him, it'll be $2.75, sir or ma'am. I'll get the food, and I was very fast. So here comes this owner, one day unexpectedly from his vacation, and what am I doing? Working the window.
Yikes.
He came to me and said, you're fired. And the manager looked at him and said, sir, just watch him. So he took a reading, which is how much money. He took a reading from the other window, which is another kid working. And I did three times as much volume, took in, as the other kid. And I was fast. He'll go check the numbers that I gave him, the right number to the customers. He came back and said, from now on, if I see you working anything but the window, you're fired.
So he had a little change of tune.
But yes.
There's so much to your story. There is a point where you're in a position to take over a spot, and you end up taking over a McDonald's in Kansas City, Kansas. Where was it exactly?
It was on 9th in Minnesota.
What was it like there? Who went there?
Well, it was a mixed neighborhood.
And what year are we talking about?
That was 1968.
That's a tumultuous year everywhere in Kansas City, too.
About a week after Martin Luther King was shot.
That's when you took over?
I took over before he was shot.
Okay.
And after he was shot, they had riots in Kansas City, Kansas. They demolished every single storefront in the street. The Black Panthers came in there and looked. They said, how come you're still open? I said, sir, you can tell from my accent, I'm not from here. Black people, white people, they're all customers, and I call them sir, and I call them ma'am. Serve them with all my heart. They looked at me and said, here's a number. We'll tell people not to touch you, and if anybody bothers you, call us. I was the only one that stayed open.
Wow. Did you have other really memorable interactions with customers?
A lot.
You know, what was your overall feeling about McDonald's back then?
I loved it. It was, I was making $1,100 a month working at McDonald's as a manager. Then the owner of that restaurant asked me to do something illegal, immoral, and unethical, and I gave him notice to leave. I went to McDonald's Corporation. Fred Turner was the president. Ray Kroc was the chairman.
Ray Kroc, and he's the main character in the
That's
movie.
That's right.
The founder.
Yeah, and I know him well. Actually, they used to come to the restaurant and tell me, hey, don't wear tennis shoes. It's going to break your back. Go get better shoes. That's Ray Kroc. Show me how to mop the floor. Don't push it back and forth. He said, stand up and go side to side. And he was interested in that kind of little stuff. So, again, that's a long story. I went to McDonald's. I said, listen, I worked for McDonald's 8.5 years. I'm leaving my employment. If you have any restaurant, McDonald's, anywhere in the country that is not doing well, I'd like to get it. Amazing. As we were talking to Mr. Turner at that time, here comes this field consultant from McDonald's Corporation that represents McDonald's in Kansas City. So Fred called and said, Jack, come here, tell me what you can tell me about Nabil Haddad. He looked at him and said, sir, he is the best manager we have in the country.
Your story, I mean, they might as well have made the movie about this story, but I want to get back to it. Let's talk now with someone else who was involved in McDonald's at around the same time, someone you know, Bob Bernstein of the Kansas City-based Bernstein Rain Advertising, and he is the inventor of the Happy Meal.
He's a genius.
And he's with us by Skype.
I did take an exception to that.
Ooh, okay.
I started the Happy Meal in Raytown, Missouri.
Oh, a little rivalry.
Yeah, but then you know, I'm sure he, it wasn't national. It was just local. I put it in a bag, hamburger, fries, and a Coke for a certain price and call it the Happy Meal. And I had people put on their jackets, shirts from the football team, hubcaps and everything, and we used to dance, send the janitor to clean the lobby and dance on Bill Haley and his Comets. Song, so it's rock and roll. And then Bob Bernstein, he's a genius. I love him.
Let's hear his version of this story.
He took the vision and made it national.
Bob Bernstein, what do you say to all of this?
Nabil, how are you?
Bob, you're a genius, and I said that about you. You're phenomenal.
Come Bob, on now, Bill.
No, Bob has made...
You know better than that.
No, Bob made...
You know better than that.
Bob made McDonald's in Kansas City what it is.
Bob, how did you do that? What brought you into the world of McDonald's?
Well, I was a small agency back in 1967 when McDonald's was looking for an advertising agency. And they looked at 17 agencies. We were fortunate enough to be selected as the agency. There were only six or eight of us in the agency at that time. And we were not doing that much in billing, a very small agency, one of 125 in Kansas City at the time. But McDonald's selected us out of the 17 agencies, and we were very fortunate.
So do you corroborate Nabil's version of this story?
Well, I have to be honest. I'm sure if he says he did it, I'm sure he did it. I just didn't know about it. And I'm sorry, Bill, but that's not something I knew about at the time. But I have a different story about how we started the Happy Meal.
Tell it.
All right. Well, first of all, when I started with McDonald's, we did many promotions for McDonald's, mainly children's promotions. I actually had copyrights and registered over 20 different premium items for McDonald's, everything from a Happy Cup in 1968 to Happy Plates, Ronald Rings, Flying Hamburger, Pencil Puppets, Magic Lid, just a lot of different programs.
Sippy Dipper.
Sippy Dipper Straw, which was the best, you're right. Nabil, that was the best, Sippy Dipper Straw.
I know.
That all preceded the Happy Meal, which was 1976. And actually, the Happy Meal was the last premium that I did for McDonald's out of the 20 ones before them.
I've heard that you were inspired by your son.
That's correct. We were looking for a meal concept, and we were a children's meal concept. And as Nabil had said, a lot of people had looked at it and had done different programs trying to come up with a meal concept that would stick. And, of course, being the ad agency, we had a lot of ability to enact it within the co-op, the owners of the McDonald's franchises. And so we were looking for a meal concept. And we, at that time, had represented Denver, Phoenix, and Kansas City, those markets. And the McDonald's restaurants were changing. They were becoming brick buildings. They were going away from their red and white tile. They were becoming less child-friendly. And we were worried that we were not going to be as friendly to children as we should be. So we wanted to do something to bring that around. And also we noticed a lot of women were buying, a lot of mothers were buying hamburgers, cheeseburgers, dividing them up among their children, taking French fries and giving a few to this one and a few to that one, getting a large drink, asking for a courtesy cup, and then pouring some of it into the courtesy cup for their kids. So we said it would be much easier and much better if the child had his own meal, his or her own meal. And so I, at that time, I was also, we were working on that back at the agency, but also in the morning, I would notice my son, Steve, who, by the way, is now president and CEO of our ad agency. And he was 9 years old at the time. And I was watching him eat his cereal every morning. And every morning he would read the cereal box over and over and over again, same box. And he would keep doing it. And he was a good student. I knew that he knew how to read pretty well. And so I thought, why would he read the same thing over and over again? So I asked him one morning, why are you doing that? And he kind of ate his cereal and he said, I don't know, I just something to do. He said, I just wanted something to do while I'm eating. And so I thought to myself, you know, it'd be nice if the kids had something to do while they ate at McDonald's, if they had a box that they could look at and it had at least 10 items on it that were puzzles, games, riddles, something that the children could look at and figure out while they're eating their meal. And if we rotated the boxes, we would have a lot of different programs going, and the kids would like it, and they're very content looking at the same one more than once. So we started out on that premise and found some international, really, designers.
Yeah,
who designed our boxes.
I hate to hurry you along, but we've got to move on pretty soon. And it sounds like, I mean, I think most people now are familiar with what the Happy Meal became and what it was like. I mean, does the McDonald's you've been hearing about from Nabil, is that the McDonald's that you knew as well? Or is there anything that you'd like to add about just sort of a McDonald's of another era and how that felt in this country?
No, I think Nabil sums it up pretty well. He certainly was at the ground level and knew McDonald's as well as anyone. And McDonald's at that time, you know, was in Kansas City. We were a market that was developed later than the other markets. And we only had 9 stores when I started in 1967 with them. They only had 9 stores. And they weren't doing very, very good volumes. And most of the owners had either other jobs or their wives were working. And so it was a tough time for them. They were way below national average.
Interesting.
And so it was, but it's grown, you know, from 9 stores, there's 140 stores in greater Kansas City today.
Thank you so much, Bob. It's been great hearing your story.
Yes. My pleasure.
Good to hear from you, Bob. And I still think you're a genius.
You take care of yourself. Say hello to your family, will you?
Nabil, we're going to have to skip over the story behind starting Winstead's, but how was Winstead's different from McDonald's?
Well, the product is different. McDonald's is a hamburger place, and a hamburger is anything in a cow that is meat. I mean, hearts, lungs, anything. And Winstead's is steak burgers. Winstead's is made out of round steak. Like if you go to a country club, they'll show you this round steak, they slice it steak for you. So ours is ground steak.
So, you know, I wonder, was it important to you and has it been important to you for Winstead's to be local and not go national? That's sort of at the crux of the plot and the founder. The two brothers who started McDonald's, at least according to the movie, were these innovative burger stand guys who wanted it to be this sweet little family-friendly place where their ideas about food were upheld. And Ray Kroc, who has, he's the other side of the story, he has big ambitions, more locations. He's pushing for bigger profits, that kind of thing.
I didn't have Bob Bernstein or the money to go national with Winstead's. I've always wanted to. But the reason I did not is because while I was in Winstead's several years, Frank Morgan from Merchants Bank called me and asked me if I would look at a company that he loaned $50 million for and they're struggling, can't make it. So I met with him for 10 minutes, 6:30 in the morning, and asked me two questions. Can you get managers? And can you make a profit? It was Plaza 3, Fedora, Fred Piazza, and actually they had some 25 or 30 stores all over the country. Washington, D.C., Ripster's in Annandale, and New Orleans. And so I responded to him by saying, I sure can.
Well, Nabil Haddad, this has been fascinating. When KCUR's Central Standard comes back, we're going to hear from someone who works for McDonald's today. I'm Gina Kaufman. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is a Screen Time episode of KCUR's Central Standard, and today we're talking about The Founder, a movie that tells the origin story of McDonald's. It's a movie about the ambition of a businessman, the struggle to get ahead, and the soul of an insanely popular fast food joint. We were hearing from Nabil Haddad, who is part of Winstead's. I mean, he's the Winstead's guy in Kansas City after working at McDonald's in the 1960s. He started out there cleaning bathrooms and really rose through the ranks. Now let's get into McDonald's today. I'd like to welcome Richard Eicher to the studio. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
Did you recognize the McDonald's you heard about in those stories? I mean, is that the McDonald's that you've known for the last 25 years?
There's a lot of similarities, but, you know, this economic situation has changed since then. You know, there isn't as much mobility as there used to be in the world of fast food.
How did you get started in fast food at McDonald's in specific?
Well, after high school, I wanted to go to Longview Community College. I was living in South Kansas City, and I drove to school, Longview Community College, on Longview Road, and they were right next to 71 High, but there was a McDonald's. Fasted every day. So I'm going to go in there. I drive everybody fasted. I'll apply. And I was hired. I started working in front line and moved to, and went from kitchen, you know, to drive through to ultimately working in maintenance and janitorial. And there's where I remained for most of the last 15 some years.
So Nabil's story kind of started in janitorial and moved quickly from there. Did you ever, he talked about an opportunity, you know, when the manager was away and he worked at the window, tried something different. Are there opportunities like that now?
Not as much. I mean, they're only about 2% of fast food workers are in management. So there's a lot, majority of people who do the bulk of the work. And so, I mean, in terms of maintenance for myself, I'm one of those people who has at last enjoys a sense of accomplishment. I go in every day. I work hard. I mean, I clean the bathrooms every day. You know, and when I turn around and look back, I can see all that I have accomplished. I've seen what I have done, and I am proud of it. You know, and it's a shame that I have to struggle so hard to survive.
Well, this is a good time to mention that you're part of Stand Up KC, and that's the fight for a higher wage for local fast food workers. You know, what got you into that movement? How long had you been at McDonald's when that all got started?
Well, I've been in the fast food industry for nearly 25 years, ever since I got out of, almost since I got out of high school. What got me into the Stand Up KC is that they had a strike right in front of the McDonald's I worked at. And from there, I made inquiries about what this was about, what was going on. This was something I wanted to be part of. I knew this was part of a struggle to make things better, and I wasn't just working and going home to my empty apartment. Wasn't changing my life for better. So this was a chance to be a part of something bigger, part of something to make a difference, not just in my life, but in the lives of millions of hardworking Americans.
What's it been like for you to be all at once working for McDonald's and also, in some ways, fighting McDonald's?
Well, It is. There are some interesting. Because here's an interesting story, and I began talking to them because I had experience working for both corporate and owners, and they were interested in how kind of power and influence corporate McDonald's exerts over the owners. And you know, we've said McDonald's is the boss; they are the ones who call the shots. And I was asked to give a speech about this. My first public speech, right at the corner opposite the very store that I worked at. I believe it. I was a little nervous, to say the least. That was my first public address, and that was how I, and I've been spoken more since then. But I spoke about how the National Labor Relations Board ruled that McDonald's was considered a joint employer.
What does that mean?
It means that they're also, that they are, why people were suing these owner and these franchises for discriminatory practices, overtime and stuff, and they ruled that the McDonald's could be named in the suits because they had such control over them. They're also an employer of these workers.
Have you enjoyed working for McDonald's?
Yes, I have.
Tell me about just the day in and day out. Like, what's the first thing you do when you arrive at McDonald's for work?
Well, I work early morning shift, which is from anywhere from 4, of course, starts at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the morning. And so I get there, of course, you know, you can't really have teenagers working at that early. There's always adults like myself, hardworking adults like myself. So I come in, you know, one of the first jobs I do is I go outside and I pick up all the trash because an good exterior store look good outside, you know. And I go get ready, get the sanitized towels up, and then I clean the grills, you know, I take out the trash. I clean the bathrooms. I mean, I do all these things. A lot of this stuff is done even before we open the store, you know. So we get everything looking good when we open. And then during the day, I'm helping out. I'm bringing up fries from the freezer and doing things like that, getting ice. You know, I'm helping out. I'm mopping. I'm sweeping. Going outside periodically to keep sure the lot key's nice. Taking out the trash. I mean, I'm organizing the stock room, the walk-in, the freezer. I'm getting those organized. Taking care, you know, sometimes taking care of the lobby, taking care of the windows, going up on the roof at times.
If you could do anything, what would you do?
What?
If you could do anything, what would you do?
I would love to continue working at what I'm doing. You know, it's just there's people who I enjoy my job, you know.
What do you enjoy about it?
I just enjoy the sense of accomplishment that I get out of it. You know, I actually can physically see what I have accomplished and what I have done at the end of the day.
Do you, so it sounds like if you want to do the same thing and you just want the payment structure.
This is my career. This is my profession. You know, this is my job and someone has to do it. Someone has to clean. Someone has to maintain the equipment. You know, and I feel that I shouldn't have to struggle, you know, to keep my lights on or worry about my car being repossessed. You know, when we have our breaks, I get a discount for my meals. There and sometimes that's the only meal I eat during the day because I have nothing at home. You know, these are situations, these are the things that why we're fighting, why we're organizing and fighting for a living wage and a union.
Do you, after working at a place for 25 years, it would on the one hand be sort of reasonable to think that this place would feel like home, but then a lot of the things you're describing, especially with the payment issue, might complicate that. I wonder how you emotionally feel about McDonald's.
Well, as terms of a corporate McDonald's, you know, they're a multi-billion-dollar company, you know, who controls and sets things. You know, I've gone to Chicago for protest at the corporate headquarters. You know, it's a corporate culture. That permeates all the way down through the system that we as our workers are fighting against. And that's our struggles against. I mean, there's a lot of good things, but there are also a lot of bad things too.
Do you mind my asking what McDonald's location you work at?
6406 Troost.
How do you, there's McDonald's, the big corporation, and then there's this spot on this street corner in this particular city. And how, can you tell me about that? Does it have its own flavor, its own character, or is the corporate structure so deeply permeating it that it doesn't?
Well, I mean, McDonald's are McDonald's. Wherever you go, it's a McDonald's. You know, they have the set standard of how the store exterior is going to look, what kind of equipment goes into it, even interior decorations are all set by corporate. So, I mean, you really see how, while they pushing all of this consistency all nationwide. So, you know, it's a lot like a corporate store in many ways.
Do you have regulars?
Yes, we do. We have regulars every day, and some of them come up to me and say, Richard, every time we come in, you're always working.
Do you have a favorite story about an interaction with a customer?
Oh, well, I have several interactions. There's people, like I said, those ones who come in and say, you know, they're seen every day. I've had customers come in, you know, recently when the Supreme Court, for instance, came out, Missouri Supreme Court ruled that the petition for $15 or in a way could be put on the ballot. I had customers come in and say, Richard, I'm going to vote for that. It's an encouragement, you know, to see that. You know, there's people who've heard about me from Stand Up KC coming to me and saying how they appreciate or they sympathize with the job I am doing. That always feels good.
Have you seen the movie The Founder?
No, I have not.
Is there anything that if you were going to see it that you would be wondering or wanting to know or that you're curious about the history of this place that is someplace that you love but someplace that you have a real fight with?
I'm kind of curious of the story because I've heard it mentioned that he starts out like an underdog, but then he kind of transforms as the movie progresses into something more sinister and more swarmy. I mean, you know, and
it says Ray Kroc,
you know, yeah. And it paints a picture of the fact, you know, that, you know, oftentimes a form of ruthlessness is sadly necessary to succeed in our economy.
Well, our time is sadly up for the personal Kansas City stories, but Richard Eicher of McDonald's and Stand Up KC, thank you so much for taking the time to be here.
Thank you.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, our critic will weigh in on The Founder. I'm Gina Kaufman. Back in a minute. Hi, Russ.
Good morning.
That's Russ Simmons. He's our screen time critic here on KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm Gina Kaufman. We're talking about The Founder. It's a movie about McDonald's, and Russ, did you like the movie?
I did like the movie. I think Richard set us up perfectly with his description earlier.
The ruthlessness of Ray Kroc, who is the founder character played by Michael Keaton.
Correct. And you know, it's interesting to me, the most interesting aspect of the movie really is that it sets up the audience the same way the TV series Breaking Bad did. They give you a character who's an underdog and has you root for that character until that character has a change in their personality and becomes something less than noble. And that's exactly what happens with Ray Kroc, because he evolves from the underdog who's just doing the best he can and working hard and trying to make it in life and to fulfill his dream. And he becomes a backstabbing manipulator, wresting the McDonald's franchise away from the men who really did found it, the true founders, the McDonald's brothers.
Did you totally love the Ray Kroc character at the beginning, though? I had mixed feelings about him. I'll admit it. I felt his struggle as this down on his luck salesman who's tried 1,000 different things in an attempt to get ahead. But when you see him kind of practicing his line, there's this kind of smarmy side, and his relationship with his wife, at least as it was portrayed in the movie, gives you a sense that at least when the doors are shut, he was never really afraid to use someone else as a stepping stone.
Now, that's a good point, although I think that maybe my perception there was tempered by the fact that I knew in advance the Ray Kroc he would evolve into. I think, however, for people that maybe don't know the story, I think they would think that Michael Keaton's character is really a guy that they can get behind. And after all, he was a small-town milkshake distributor. He was really trying to do his best and working hard under really tough circumstances until he had a dream.
Which is usually a good thing, but alas.
Usually.
So did this movie make you think differently about anything?
Going to McDonald's now is going to be a little bit of a different experience for me because I, you know, understand that the power comes from the top down and not from the bottom up, as did with, you know, the McDonald's in their heyday when they had created their franchise.
And there is a lot of like old footage from advertising and then documentation of those early days of that original burger joint from the two brothers,
right,
who started it in San Bernardino.
Right. One of the most interesting aspects of the movie to me was when they went out to a tennis court and they etched out in chalk the outline of the restaurant, how it would work most efficiently. And they just kept changing it and changing it until they realized what is going to work for this fast food image that they had in their mind. And, you know, and you realize that these guys were like the Henry Ford of fast food. You know, they were creating this assembly line.
I'm guessing that there has to be some kind of back and forth between filmmakers and McDonald's in a situation like this. I mean, what do you know about that? There's a lot in the movie that is actually kind of celebratory. I mean, it recognizes, like you were saying, how innovative the McDonald's concept was in its earliest days and how important McDonald's has been to American culture, I mean, for better or for worse.
Right.
But it's still not exactly a rosy portrait.
No, but you know what? I think that McDonald's, and one of the, another interesting aspect of the film is that that Michael Keaton's character says it's like the cross or the county courthouse or these things that are emblematic of family America, and that's what he wanted to emphasize. He didn't want it to be called Crocs because Crocs not a good name. McDonald's is a good solid American name, and that is exactly what he was pushing.
And that branding has always. But do you know what McDonald's has thought about this movie?
Well, it's my understanding that McDonald's has decided to take a hands-off approach because they don't want to give the movie any more publicity than it has. It's sort of the same thing that happened with Social Network. You know, Facebook, when it came about, you know, it wasn't necessarily given the Mark Zuckerberg wasn't exactly given the best, you know, spot. You know, he was a little bit of a character who had some flaws. Let's just put it that way. And rather than pushing their trademark restrictions, they decided to take a hands-off approach. And I think that's what McDonald's is doing here.
What do you think would be the difference between seeing a documentary like Fast Food Nation or if this same subject matter had been treated in more of a documentary style approach? I mean, is there something that one format like this dramatization versus documentary, is there something that one can do that the other can't?
Well, certainly. But I think one of the things that a documentary can't do is portray Ray Kroc's off-screen persona that Michael Keaton is able to do in a drama. I mean, you see his interactions with people that never would have been captured by a documentary camera. However, it is interesting in this film, they do have some short interviews at the end over the end credits with the real Ray Kroc. And so it's kind of interesting to just juxtapose that with the character that you see Michael Keaton portraying in the film.
Tell me about the performances as long as Michael Keaton has come up.
Oh, I think he was terrific. You know, Michael Keaton is very dynamic, but he's a guy that because of his previous roles, you can kind of get behind because let's face it, for the most part, he's played heroic characters. Hey, after all, he's Batman. You know, so he's someone that brings that along with him, sort of like Tom Hanks does. And so he's, I think, well suited to play this character.
There's something unusual about the way he speaks in this movie. I mean, he seems to be so enthusiastic about everything he's saying that every now and then he kind of trips over his tongue, which, you know, Michael Keaton doesn't trip over his tongue.
That's true. But you know what? That's the whole salesman thing. He really, as you were saying, he seems a bit smarmy in some of the early scenes as he's giving his spiel, the same spiel every time he sells his milkshake machines. Michael Keaton was able to capture that very well, I thought.
What's your relationship with McDonald's, Russ?
Sadly, when I was in college, I used to go every day. When I was in junior college, me and two of my friends from high school who were going to college together went to McDonald's Monday through Friday because it was cheap, it was fast, and we knew we could get in and out. And I'm amazed we survived.
You were one of those regulars we
I
heard
was.
About.
That's right.
Well, our time is up. Russ Simmons, this has been great. Thank you.
Thank you.
We've heard today also from Nabil Haddad of Winstead's, Bob Bernstein of Bernstein Rain, and Richard Eicher, a McDonald's employee who's part of Stand Up KC. That's the local fast food workers movement for a higher minimum wage. You can listen back to all of it at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Tomorrow, another national phenomenon with a local story behind it, The Wizard of Oz. We'll be looking at our culture through the lens of Wizard of Oz toys. Tune in tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Todd Hope, and Suzanne Hogan. Caitlin Troutman is our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.